Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Super Metal World Podcast. This is Michael.
And it's Ty.
This week, we've got for you an interview we had with Albert Mudrian, editor-in-chief at Decibel Magazine. He was really interesting to talk to. He's got a ton of experience in metal as a editor-in-chief, writer, event organizer, all sorts of...
He does it all. Of,
yeah,
he's like a...
Busy
Swiss Army knife of,
seriously,
of metal influence and knowledge and everything. So it was really interesting to talk to him about how Decibel works and a little behind the scenes and what Decibel's up to. Talked a little bit about kind of Albert's history of how Decibel started, his opinion on the state of metal as it sits today, his opinion on legacy bands.
Got into beer and metal?
Yes. And... yeah, I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. So I don't want to take away from it. We talked to him for well over an hour and a half, which was awesome. You guys will like the content. Remember that you can find us at www.supermetalworld.com. You can also email us at supermetalworld@gmail.com. If you are a return listener, thanks so much for listening. Keep
listening.
We appreciate
it.
Yeah. And if you are new to listening, welcome. And we hope you continue to listen to more of our podcasts and go ahead and check out our site. We are a new and up-and-coming site, but we're very proud of the content. And it was nice to talk to Albert because a lot of the heart and soul that he puts into Decibel, we've also been trying to put into our website as well.
Yeah, a lot of affirmation on our end as far as the quality of the content and the thought that goes into it, which is obviously present when you read anything from Decibel.
And iTunes, rate and review, please. Give us a 5-star review and rating, whatever. And we're on all your social media. Go follow us. Talk to us. We love to hear from you guys about thoughts on the podcast, thoughts on the website, and everything in between. Hope you guys enjoy. Horns high. We're here with Albert Mudrian. He's the editor-in-chief of Decibel Magazine. He's blessed us by being on the podcast. How are you doing, Albert?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Pretty great. Not bad for a Monday. Monday the 13th.
I was impressed that you were able to pronounce my last name with, like, not even asking and nail it 100%. People usually go for the Mudrian or something. They don't go right to the Mudrian. Very nice. Nicely done.
I have to confess that I did my homework a little bit, and I listened to a Metal Sucks podcast.
Oh, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that.
Yeah, I listened to...
Just kidding. Nice guys.
I listened to the part right at the beginning when they introduced you, because I was like, is it Mudrian or Mudrian? And I was surprised that it was Mudrian.
Well, that's great, though. I mean, most people wouldn't go through such lengths. So, again, commendable job.
I appreciate it. So... I just want to hit you with a question right away. You know, it's a Monday. I'm curious, being the editor-in-chief of a magazine like Decibel, what's your day-to-day like? You know, sun up to sundown, what's Albert doing?
It could be completely different depending on what kind of deadline I'm facing at the time, just because if Decibel was kind of a normal magazine and we were just publishing a monthly print magazine and just cranking out 12 issues a year, it would be pretty easy to just kind of fall into a monthly production schedule of, hey, this week I'm assigning writers, and then this week I'm scheduled, you know, I'm doing photo editing, and this week I'm editing, and this week we're in production. But, you know, we produce an annual national tour. We do, as of this moment, two annual metal and beer festivals, one in Philadelphia, one in Los Angeles. We have a flexi disc series that's been in the magazine coming up on 8 years. So that's something that needs to be curated regularly, talking to artists directly to see if they might be able to record some exclusive tracks for us, and then working with a vinyl printer to make sure that those production schedules are met, because there's literally one place in the world that can produce flexies at the volume we need them for the magazine. So you need to stay on a really, really tight production schedule to make sure that the flexies actually make it into the magazine each month. There's that. There's the running of the actual website, which has content updated daily. There's probably around 5 or 6 new pieces of editorial that appear on the website every day. There are Decibel books, which we haven't produced any in 2018, but we did one in 2017, two in 2016, one in 2015, and we have 2 on the docket for 2019. So we're kind of in the process of moving those along. They're not necessarily in full production yet, but they're being written and edited now, and kind of going back and forth with the authors of those, making sure that they are within our production timeline, make sure they don't have any huge issues coming up on, you know, whether they're unable to get a key interview for their book or a key photo or, you know, whatever it is. So there's managing that, just managing a production staff of like 5 people who sell ads, do marketing, do art directing, do distribution, because, you know, the magazine still makes it out to newsstands, handling our web store, which is actually a huge source of revenue for the magazine, because after 14 years, we have probably about 120 back issues still in print that are in stock. We have our books. We have we have merch, like t-shirts. We stock other metal history-related books that I've kind of curated in our library that I think are like-minded with the stuff that we cover and some of the books that we've produced. So honestly, it really depends on whatever's due that day. No 2 days are different at this point. I don't know if that's the most satisfying answer to that question, but that's honestly the truth.
Well, the variety must be nice, though. Kind of keeps you on your toes.
It's an adventure every day. Yeah, I don't get bored. And in fact, at times I was thinking, like, you know, if we were just, you know, like, it's 14 years this week that the magazine has been in existence, and obviously when we started, it was just a magazine. So I just thought to myself, you know, if I'm still doing that, like, you know, 14 years down the line, would I be into it? You know, would I still care? And I think the answer is probably yes, but I don't know how viable of a commercial enterprise it would be. I guess it could still work, but I don't know if the brand reach would be quite as impactful with only a print component, you know, in 2018.
Right, you're saying you kind of had to make the jump to going online and kind of doing the online store and all these other ways to make revenue. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think that in any form of business, diversifying your revenue streams is a smart way to go, because, you know, if something happens in one area, you have potentially another stream to make it back on. And just the general ebb and flow of things allows you to maybe invest in something like the festivals maybe a little bit more for a couple of years, and then maybe invest in the books a little bit more for a couple of years. And, you know, when something like maybe ad sales are a little slower 1 year, and then web store revenue stream is a lot higher that year, like you have a lot of opportunities to kind of make it up if something is down, and you have a lot of opportunities to do really well if everything happens to be up. I mean, the key has always been like doing it in a natural way that isn't just gross, you know, like even the word brand is kind of icky in and of itself, but it's like, I think if you're genuine about the things that you're producing, and I mean, at the end of the day, I'm a fan. Like, I didn't get into this to have a career. It just kind of happened that I was fortunate enough that I kind of do have one. But it wasn't the impetus. I didn't like see this niche and thought, you know what I'm going to do with my life. Right. Yeah, I was just like, oh, this would be cool. Let's try this out and see what happens. But, so I think at the end of the day, I'm still kind of motivated by like, what would I want to do? What would I want as a fan of this music? What kind of experiences would I want? What kind of products would I want to own? Not what, so it isn't coming from like somebody who has a marketing degree or somebody who is a product manager. You know, it's like coming from somebody who is a fan. So I think that like, I can kind of imagine what, I mean, I know what I would want, and I think that there are a lot of people that are in my age group that kind of want similar things, and by the successes we've had with the magazine and the books and the Flexi series and the tour and the festivals, it's like, I think I was, you know, turned out I was right in a lot of respects, and that, yeah, there were more people wanting these things that I wanted, and they weren't getting them necessarily in other places.
And what do you think are these, what are these things that you're talking about, you know, like, you're kind of generally talking about them, but like specifically what are you envisioning that the consumer wants and that ends up to be paying off for you?
Well, I think that the consumer wants, I mean, I don't know necessarily all consumers. I just know that people like, let's just say people like me,
sure.
43-year-old white males who are, hanging on to what's left of youth. and, you know, they don't get out as often as they used to because there's, you know, chasing two kids around and they've got, like, just kind of maybe some of their responsibilities are a little more mundane than they were 10 years ago. But it isn't, you know, it isn't just purely nostalgia-driven because I think, like, there's plenty of people my age that still actually do listen to new music and want to hear new bands and kind of, you know, in addition to kind of checking in on what the old guard is up to, they also have a genuine interest in hearing new sounds. I think that's something at least that's more true of metal fans than maybe other types of music, where I think they're still maybe a little more adventurous, even though the genre is branded as nostalgic. But anyway, not to dovetail, but to try to answer your question, I think, you know, this specifically, some of the things that that we are doing and that are kind of extensions of the magazine, you know, like the Decibel Hall of Fame series is probably, well, definitely is the most popular feature in the magazine for, you know, 14 years now. And we've been able to publish two books based out of that series. One, we didn't actually publish. We sold... we did a deal with DiCapo Press back in 2009 to publish the first volume of Hall of Fame pieces, and then we did our own second volume a couple of years ago that we, you know, we published under Decibel Books, and both of those have been successful. The first one sold out, and the second one is well on its way. So I think that people appreciate that series in particular, and I think that series basically being a collection of long form journalism, like 5,000-6,000 word pieces on very specific classic metal records. I think it speaks to a really rabid and interested fan base that kind of want to know everything about the things that they like the most, you know, like they don't get to read 5,000 word pieces on Rotting Christ albums from 1993 anywhere else, you know. So hey, Decibel does that, and I've always wanted to read that. So yeah, I'm going to buy that book, or I'm going to buy that issue, or whatever it is. And then with the tour, you know, being able to kind of package bands that wouldn't necessarily go out together, or to kind of put our stamp of approval on some younger bands, and put them together with some classic bands without any, you know, without any of that like traditional label buy-on garbage or one band scratching another band's back to get on the road. Like there's none of that ever goes on with the tour. It really is me kind of going through and, looking at bands and trying to come up with interesting, compelling pairings that haven't happened before.
So it's you who makes that, is it you and a group of people that decide what bands are on that tour?
It's me and one other guy by the name of Nick Storch, who's a booking agent at Artist Group. And I've worked with him on the tour since, 2011.
Okay.
The first year we did it was 2012. We started working on it in 2011. But essentially he's a booking agent. So he is a guy who has all the experience in routing tours and getting the best deals in rooms all across North America. And then, you know, he's a fan of the magazine, so he understands the vision of what we're trying to do. So when I say, you know, it'd be awesome if we could put At the Gates together with Converge and Pallbearer, and most people would say, oh yeah, that sounds like a nightmare. he goes, you know what? That's great. Let's do that. You know, let's figure that out. So yeah. And then with Metal and Beer Fest, that's something, as far as the curation and booking of that goes, I do all of that myself. As far as the bands go, Decibel's marketing manager, Alex Yard, she's like basically co-produces that event with me and handles a lot of the stuff on the brewery side of things. Like, you know, we kind of pick and choose what breweries we think are good fits together, but then all the nuts and bolts of the beer and all the paperwork that goes along with making sure 20 breweries from all over the country, sometimes outside of the country, have the proper documentation to pour their beers at a 2-day weekend festival, making sure that's all in order. It's a lot of moving parts.
Are the breweries that are coming to the festival, are they all heavy metal themed or inspired? Are you guys trying the beer before that hand, or how does that work?
The first couple of years they have been, I mean, they all have some metal connection.
Okay.
Some of them are super overt, like True Brewing in Denver, Colorado, or Three Floyds Brewing in Indiana. Some of them, like, I didn't even realize they had metal connections until, you know, the first year we did one. After we did one, like, I had a flurry of breweries get in touch with us, and, like, you know, a guy just like, hey, I'm the head brewer. I've been a subscriber to the magazine for a decade or whatever, and we would love to get involved. And, you know, we're a startup brewery. We've only been around, you know, a couple of years, but we have like this great reputation, and we're all metal guys. We named our brewery after a Sleep album, whatever it is. Like, all this stuff kind of like comes to the surface when you kind of introduce the first one into the world. So after we got the first one off the ground in the spring of 2017, it's come a little easier, because we did one in Philly in spring 2017, another in Philly in spring 2018. The next one is going to be in Los Angeles in December 2018, and then there'll be another one in Philly in April 2019, which I'm booking right now.
Okay.
Cool. But so yeah, it's definitely like, there's definitely crossover, like breweries do collaboration beers with bands that are performing at the event. Weyerbacher Brewing, which is actually my personal favorite brewery, because, I mean, that's another thing. I am a huge craft beer fan, and I have a lot of metal friends who are also huge craft beer fans. I just, you know, this was an event that I tried to get off the ground for several years before we actually got it running in 2017. And it was just, I didn't really have the correct staff in place, but it was this thing. I always thought like, hey, this is awesome. Why isn't anybody doing this? We should do this. And I just kept thinking like, I can't be the only person who would want this. And, you know, it turned out again, it's true. I wasn't. There were thousands of people who are showing up to this thing annually, or twice a year.
I wonder what the correlation is between metal fans and craft brewery. I feel like they pair together nicely.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a sense of adventurousness and extremity, and not like wanting to settle for the mundane, you know? I think mm-hmm. I don't just want to choke down another Michelob. I want to try something. I don't want to sit here and just listen to this Nickelback song.
Right.
I want more. I want this experience to be more dynamic. And I think I think craft beer is a much more dynamic version of beer, and extreme music is a much more, a much more empowering and nuanced version of like just kind of traditional rock music. So I think the correlation, I think that's where you kind of see it. You know, people who are not afraid to go like all in on a Carcass record, they're probably not going to be all afraid to go all in on a 12% ABV beer right. and try it out, see how it goes.
Yeah, I feel like the festival in itself is kind of proving that correlation. So maybe you should run some statistics on this.
Yeah, I think the statistics are the ticket sales.
Yeah, there you go.
Like,
yeah,
that's true.
When people are showing up, and because the tickets aren't cheap, because they get, you know, they have to, it's like, we have to pay for this beer, because if you buy a metal and beer ticket, you're getting, you know, access to these bands over the weekend, and then all of these pours from all of these craft breweries are included in your ticket price. So, you know, it's obviously like, it's not a cheap show, but like, it's the kind of thing that like, if you did the math and you went to a show with like 8 bands playing, like a festival show, and you're like, yeah, I'd probably buy 3 or 4 beers that day. You would have bought 3 or 4 beers from a bar, and they had been crappier, more expensive beers that you could get at your grocery store for like a third of the price, versus the, you know, the experience of like coming to an event like this, getting to try all these things that you literally have never all been in the same room together before. And having that experience and having that being actually cheaper than, you know, what you would have normally done at a regular like festival day show or a super long lineup show.
Now, you may have said this, but are there any festival dates left this year?
Yeah, we have, it's December 1st and 2nd in Los Angeles at the Wiltern. And we're announcing the final lineup or final bands for the lineup on Monday, August 20th.
Okay.
But right now, our headliners have been announced, and one day Testament is playing, and they're doing a special set of their The Gathering album and their The New Order record in both in their entirety uh-huh. for one night. And the other headliner is going to be Tom G. Warrior band Triptychon.
Okay.
And they're going to be performing an all Celtic Frost set for the awesome. First time ever on U.S. soil. So, you know, we've got like, got some pretty special headliners in the rest of the lineup. There's a lot of other good bands that have already been announced, like Pig Destroyer and Black Dahlia Murder and Chemist and Necrot and Yob and Power Trip. So, you know, there's more in store, and there's 20 breweries, and they're some of the best craft breweries, honestly, you know, that you can find in the United States. And again, they're metal themed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, again, I like to think of it as a pretty unique experience for somebody who is super into both of these things.
It sounds amazing.
Yeah. I want to go. So how many people are at these shows? You know, how many people, what's the turnout like for you guys?
I mean, we've averaged like probably about 12 to 1500 people a day at these things
mm-hmm.
at the first two in Philly. And, the capacity in Los Angeles is 2300 per day. And I'm confident that we're going to sell both of those days out in advance based on the way the tickets, like the advance tickets have been performing. Like, we're already through probably about 20% of the tickets, and we haven't even announced the full lineup or what days bands are playing yet. So we have, and you know, it's like basically just only weekend passes are available. There aren't mm-hmm. any single day passes available yet. So I think that, like, I think the potential for this thing to expand is probably greater in a market like Los Angeles, but, you know, the magazine was born in Philly, and we have a lot of Philly ties, so we definitely want to keep a version of it there, too, because, you know, Philly just doesn't have anything quite like that on the metal side, so it's nice to have something on the West Coast and something on the East Coast.
Are you at these festivals? Albert?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
You can't book something and not show up.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, especially something like that. It'd be bad luck. Everybody would be like, hey, Albert said we were going to have this, and this isn't here, so, you know, somebody needs to fix this. You kind of got to be around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to be Johnny on the spot while you're there, huh? So when Testament does something like, you mentioned Testament and Celtic Frost, doing that all Celtic mm-hmm. Frost set, is that something that they are coming to you and telling you, or do you suggest, like, hey, it would be cool if you guys did this, or is that completely kind of on the band?
No, I suggest that, you know, I say, would you guys be open to performing a set like this? And then, you know, they either they think about it and you know, we get it worked out, or they're like, nah, that's not our thing, we don't do stuff like that, or we're kind of concentrating on our new album. You know, could be a lot of different mm-hmm. Scenarios involved. I mean, the Testament one was actually pretty cool because I went to them and was like, hey, you know, can you guys do the New Order, or can you guys do the Gathering? And they actually came back and were like, hey, you know, the Gathering's only 45 minutes. How about we do the Gathering and the New Order? And I was like, holy shit, okay.
Nice.
That sounds awesome. I'm into that. So, yeah, it really depends. Like, sometimes bands that you have relationships with personally might mention something to you that, like, hey, we've thought about doing a set like this. Would you have any interest in it? Like, I can tell you right now there'll be at least two, maybe more, of those kind of special sets at the Philadelphia one in 2019. So, you know, it really, most situations, it kind of varies per situation, but, like, most of the time it's best that if you come to them with ideas.
No, I like that, though, because that's adds to the uniqueness of the show, just kind of like it adds to the uniqueness of the festival, so that's really cool.
Yeah, I think you need to do that, honestly. I think because there's only so many bands that, like, draw people consistently, and a lot of those bands tour a lot because they draw people consistently, and then you're like, well, you know, this is a more expensive ticket, so you don't want to get into a situation where people are like, hey, I just paid $30 to see this band 6 months ago. I'm not paying $85 to see them now. I don't care who else is playing or how many beers I get to drink. So you want to at least kind of make sure you're creating an experience for somebody who is like, well, I've never seen them play that before, and they're never mm-hmm. going to play that again. So, yeah, I'm in on that.
Yeah, definitely. It kind of gives you, like, yeah, I was there for that one, you know, where
right.
it's unique.
And again, it's like this thing where you have to work a little harder. And, you know, you maybe have to pay out a little bit more money up front to get them to do a special set because they deserve it. Because they're going out of their way to build something for you that they wouldn't normally do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to be cognizant of that. But at the same time, it's like, you know, it's that risk-reward. Like, you lay that out. Like, yeah, you know, this is going to take a little more time to do it this way, but it's just going to be a better experience for everybody at the end of the day. Just basically not half-assing it,
mm-hmm.
which I try to, you know, keep as our mantra for pretty much whatever we're doing.
Now, I want to get back to Decibel the magazine, Decibel the website. One question that Michael and I had when we were looking at the website, is everything that's on the website going to appear or has appeared in the magazine, or is there a difference between the two mediums?
There's a stark difference.
Okay.
I would say about 95% of what runs on the website is exclusive to the website and does not appear in the magazine. There are occasionally like features that I think that run in the magazine that I think, wow, you know, this could perform really well online. This is the kind of thing that would reach a larger audience, like a kind of a longer trend piece or something like that, that, you know, people wouldn't normally buy a magazine just to read, but might be excited to like do a deep dive on it on an online article. Like we might put something like that up every once in a while, but generally it is like, I'd say, yeah, it's got to be 95% of it that appears online does not appear in the magazine.
Okay. And so what's your take on sites like, so there's Decibel, Metal Injection, Loudwire, Metal Sucks. There's even more. But how do you find your place within all that when there's all these other online, all these other avenues to consume metal?
I mean, for us, I think it's a little easier because all those places that you mentioned, their only real source of revenue is their website.
Okay.
Like for us, like the website serves two purposes. It is a marketing tool for not only the print magazine, but, you know, all of our live events and all of our other products that we produce. But it also is a revenue source because it does generate enough traffic based on the strength of the Decibel brand and the fact that it's updated with content, you know, daily, you know, not constantly like Blabbermouth, not
right.
even as regularly as any of those other sites you mentioned. But I mean, for us, like we are not, we don't spend our days looking for articles or looking for little news items that are going to generate tons of clicks just to keep moving the page view needle along, because we've got a million other things to do. So like all those other sites that you mentioned, they all have to play that game to an extent, which is why any like big news item on like any big news item on like Metallica or something is going to get basically posted on all of those sites that you mentioned and repurposed and shared over and over again. Or any kind of like silly story, like a guy entering a mosh pit eating noodles or something like that.
Right,
that'll get like picked up and moved around all over the place, where we're kind of like, we're maybe a little bit more focused on like track premieres and album premieres and some like kind of op-ed think pieces and editorials and maybe deeper dive trend pieces, and then maybe a mix of some Q&As and maybe some historical stuff mixed in there too. Some lists. Everybody likes lists. You know,
oh, yeah.
Those are just kind of fun to do and shareable. But we don't, like, there for us, like, that's like, there's no pressure with our website, I guess is what I would say. It's like we kind of have a natural flow to it to keep stuff moving. And it's more, you know, I mean, all of our track premieres and streams, those are all people coming to us saying, can you do this? And we're like, yeah, sure. Like, you know, we're not really actively soliciting that content. So I don't, I mean, like for us, we're in a different situation than all those sites that you mentioned. So, I mean, the approach is like, we take it seriously. We want to make a good website that people come to and visit because, again, like I said, it's a revenue stream and it's an important marketing tool and it has a Decibel name on it. And you can't screw up the brand by publishing something that isn't of the highest quality, at least in our eyes. So, you know, there is work that obviously goes into maintaining it, but it isn't, you know, we're not sitting there scouring for stories. We're not continually hitting refresh on our emails and press release announcements so we can turn them into news items and that are easily shareable in the socials super quickly. I mean, occasionally when we get a heads up on a story, somebody tells me, hey, you know, this, we're announcing this tomorrow, you know, maybe we'll punch something up and push it out at the same time the announcement goes out. But it's like, again, it's not something that we're actively seeking. So we try to be a news source, I guess, in a regard, but it's very selective of what we think is newsy or is not.
Right. That makes sense. It's almost like you guys, if you want to put it in this kind of term, you guys are all serving food, but you guys, your restaurant operates under different principles.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair analogy. Yeah.
Do you think that when sites like that, you know, because like you said, Metallica is going to generate clicks, or something that Dave Mustaine thinks about something, or Corey Taylor, etc., that's going to draw clicks, and of course that helps with revenue. Do you think that at all hurts up-and-coming bands, or because they're not getting their name out there as much, or does it not really have an effect on underground bands?
I don't think it has much of an effect. I mean, because all that stuff is that content that gets shared, that's basically largely personality-based and based on somebody's opinion, whether it's an extremely correct opinion or an extremely incorrect opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just noise. And there's no way to stop that. And it's like, to me, it's almost like different things. Like, the bands that are the younger up-and-coming bands that are trying to establish themselves, they really need to establish themselves through making good music, making good records, and having good performances. So like Dave Mustaine, you know, like saying whatever he decides to say, and Blabbermouth exerting it and running with the most salacious quote, and it like getting passed around the internet, that doesn't have anything to do with like, say, how good Paul Bearer's last record is.
Right.
And it's not going to drown that out. Like, these bands, like, they're not competing voices on that level. You know what I mean? Like, their voices, like, if they start, like, ascending, if somehow, like, you know, these bands, like, I mean, even like a band like Ghost, you know, like if they start getting kind of involved in that conversation where they're now, I mean, I guess they are more or less kind of involved in that, where they're like selling records and they have a lot of, like, you know, they're controversial in the sense that they're polarizing. So people want to either, when there's something written about them, people either want to really take a big dump on it, or, you know, kind of get in their corner and defend them. So, but I think what has to happen is, like, you have to get to that place. And I think you have to get to that place on the strength of your tunes, and in the case of Ghost, on the strength of your tunes and an extremely well-developed and curated image that went along with it. And I'm not even criticizing it. I think they've done a great job with getting that out there. And, you know, it's really an element of the band, and I think they recognize that too. But, like, if all the songs sucked, it wouldn't matter, you know? Like, if Dave Mustaine didn't write any good songs 30 years ago, nobody would give a shit about him right now. So, at the end of the day, if you're not, like, if your songs aren't, like, if your songs are there, you'll eventually get to be part of the conversation over time, I guess, is what I'm saying.
You had talked about, you mentioned this earlier, that metal's kind of viewed as a, I don't know if you said nostalgia, I don't want to put words in your mouth, something about nostalgic genre. Can you expand upon that?
You can put that in my mouth, that's fine. I think that, like, a lot of criticism that I've seen leveled at, like, extreme metal in particular, or just all heavy metal, is that it's a largely nostalgia-based genre where bands don't progress dynamically over time, and the ones that do are often blacklisted or shamed for doing so, and, you know, like, people hold with like Slayer and AC/DC in the highest of regards, mm-hmm. because they've, you know, stuck to their guns or whatever and not really changed their sound. And you know, I mean, there's definitely an element to that, but like, you really just have to kind of look to the present day landscape of the mix of old guard bands and bands that have been around since the beginning, or bands that have were around and then broke up and then reunited a decade or 15 years ago when the reunion bug kind of started biting people, versus like kind of vital young bands that are around today coming up and playing stuff that's either directly inspired from those bands or a different take on those bands. I think it's like, I don't know. I think that there is a lot of, I think there's a lot of diversity in extreme music, and Jesus Christ, I'd hope so, since it's been around for over 30 years now. It should give you some time to figure some stuff out and expand on some things and figure out what's important and what isn't. I just don't think it's a whole lot different than anything else, you know, like, yeah, people hail Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, and those bands are on Metallica, and those bands are on a special pedestal, but, you know, same deal with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and rock music, you know, like, I mean, you could read, like, record reviews and indie rock magazines, I'm sure, from the past few months and find bands being compared to those bands. Like, that's just how it is. There's bands who are cornerstones of any movement. Just that these bands kind of continue to still really be vital in today's scene. And I guess the only thing that I would say that maybe is potentially problematic, and it has way more to do with the landscape of the music industry than the artists in the industry themselves, is that there really aren't bands that are kind of primed to replace those bands. Like when Slayer retires, when Iron Maiden packs it in, when Judas Priest decides, you know, we've shed enough important members at this point. So, yeah, it is. There is a question of, like, all right, who's going to rise up? Like, Ghost, Behemoth? I don't know. You know, like, it doesn't feel quite right. Like, Lamb of God? Cool band, but, you know. But that, again, has, like, so much of that has to do with just the landscape of the industry. And
the music industry, the music industry in general, right?
Yeah, and like what the tools there are now to make a band as big as, like, say, Metallica was. You know, it's just that things like that just don't happen. But, I mean, the real key is just going to be kind of like making sure there are these metal bands who can not necessarily headline 12,000 cap arenas every night, but hopefully headline 1,200 cap rooms every night in America. Like, those are the bands that, like, those are the bands that are going to, like, keep this thing alive.
Right.
So, you know, you got to kind of, like, I think you need to adjust the expectations a little bit. And when people, like, you know, talk about this idea that, like, metal's holding on to the past too much, again, I think that there's potentially some legitimate criticism for that, but like, when it's pretty clear that once that generation is gone, there's never going to be anything like it ever again, I think it's okay to want to hold on to that a little bit longer, you know, mm-hmm. especially again in the case of like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden in particular, who like still actually make good albums.
Right.
Like, it's almost ageist at this point to say, like, you shouldn't be giving them as much credit as they get. They deserve every ounce of it.
Yeah, the new Judas Priest album was awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it also has to do with, like, you know, they were Those bands were around Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Black Sabbath. I mean, they helped birth metal. And then Metallica helped, you know, take it to heights I don't know, many probably didn't think were possible. But was that all just a right place at the right time? You know, like, it's hard for me to imagine that happening again. Something like the Black Album exploding, I guess.
Something like that. You also got to remember, though, it's like, it's not like heavy metal was unestablished, if that's a word.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
In 1991. I mean, think about it. Think about how many of those thrash bands even were on major labels.
True.
Megadeth, Anthrax, Slayer. They were all on majors. Fucking Nuclear Assault was on a major from a number of records by then. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like people kind of lose sight that there was this like the biggest corporations selling this style of music back then saw that style of music as commercially viable. So they were investing in it. So it's like, yeah, I mean, Metallica exploded in a way that like few metal bands ever have, but they exploded in a way that few bands ever have.
Very
true.
It isn't just
like a kind of a metal success story. It's just a music success story that happened to a metal band. So yeah, there definitely is a right place, a right time, but it's just like kind of, it's like asking yourself, is there ever going to be another AC/DC, Back in Black? Is there ever going to be another Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction? Is there ever going to be, like, I just start thinking records that sold like 15 million copies, and then you're like, Jesus, is there ever going to be another Hootie and the Blowfish, Crack Rear View? I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's like, it's the same kind of question at that point.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Are you excited about the state of metal right now? Say more excited now than you were 5 years ago, or do you feel about the same about it?
I mean, I'm more excited about it because, I mean, I guess I'm more involved on different levels of it in a way than I was even 5 years ago with, doing the festival now and doing more books and things like that. Like any facet of the industry that we're getting more involved in, for me on a personal level, it's like, oh, wow, like learning how this works or trying to figure out ways to make, you know, something that I'm a fan of better for other people. I get excited about that. But I mean, I am like anybody else where I have days where I'm like, I don't want to listen to anything new. I don't want to check out that band.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have other days where I've like downloaded 6 new records and, you know, those records just stay in rotation for 2 weeks. So I think it's like, I think there's ebbs and flows like, you know, anything else. And a lot of it, sometimes depends on the strength of a release schedule of a particular period. But, I get excited. I mean, I like when I hear a new band, that moves me, the first thing I'm like, man, can we get them to do a flexi or can we get them on the tour? Can we get them on a festival? Like I want people to hear
mm-hmm.
this shit. So, I think I'm more excited, if anything else, again, because I feel like I have more tools at my disposal to get these things out there to people.
And what bands, let's say just today, on today, Monday, August the 13th, what bands, new bands, are you really excited about that you'd like to share with us?
Here, I can go into my iTunes playlist.
Absolutely.
Tell you what was, keep in mind, it wasn't all played through this particular format, but I can at least give you a sense of some of the things that happened.
Yeah, let's do it.
Although, you know, don't read too much into it. I don't want to give away any potential spoilers for some things that might be on the way.
Absolutely.
Outer Heaven, this death metal band from Philadelphia. They're going to have a record out on Relapse in October. It's called Realms of Eternal Decay. And it's death metal, but it's parts old school, new school, some weird tech stuff, some stuff that I don't know what the hell's going on, but it's just like, just moving me, like getting back on.
Mm-hmm.
A new track from the band Spirit Adrift. They just recorded a track for our Flexi series, and their last record, Curse of Conception, was our number two album of 2017.
Awesome.
So we're huge fans of theirs, and this new song that they wrote for us for the series is really like a huge step up even from that record. So, you know, really, really excited about them. What else is in here? I mean, this is going to be all over the place. So
oh, that's fine.
With me. This band called Abhorrence, who are an old Finnish death metal band. They are actually essentially the precursor to Amorphis. They featured Tommy, the one of the founding guitarists of Amorphis. He was in this band, and they were kind of like the original Finnish death metal sounding band.
Nice.
And they broke up after they recorded basically a couple demos in a 7-inch. And then, like, I think the story even was Relapse was about to sign them, and then they broke up, and Tommy was like, hey, I have a new band called Amorphis, sign us instead. And they kind of, you know, went on from there, but that was the end of Abhorrence, but they got back together a couple of years ago, and they just recorded a new EP, and it's only like four full songs, but I can't stop listening to it. Horrendous, who we've blabbed about repeatedly in Decibel. They've been on the Decibel tour. They've been Decibel Metal and Beer Fest. They were a part of Choosing Death Fest, which was a one-off show I did in Philly a couple of years ago. Former Album of the Year winner, former Flexi Series artist. They have their fourth record will be out on Season of Mist, I think in September, called Idol. Super interesting and progressive death metal for fans of people who like death and cynic, but for people who don't like shit that's way too wonky prog death metal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can actually listen to it, it's actually songs. New Pig Destroyer, super psyched on that. Mm-hmm. That just crushes. New Satan, the old new wave of British heavy metal band.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They have a new record out on Metal Blade called Cruel Magic. I think that's also September, but I just love that band, and they just get played all the time. A relatively new band from California called Haunt. It's actually also new wave of British heavy metal style, except, you know, it's a band from California that formed like 2 years ago, unlike Satan, who I think formed in like 1979 or something. But it's fantastic, and it's, I don't know if you've ever heard of a band called Beastmaker, who were signed to Rise Above. They're kind of a doom band. The main guy, Trevor, just started this project on the side, and it's just, at least for me anyway, it's a bit more compelling than Beastmaker, who were solid, but this is just like kind of some next level, like heavy metal anthems that are just big and hooky and catchy. New Chemist record, it's great. What else played here? Tomb Mold, Canadian death metal band. Super sick sounding stuff. Way, way, way into it. I don't know, Mantar, who I didn't particularly care about for the first couple records, but the last one, this new one, I'm not even sure if it's out yet. It might be, just really caught me, just super catchy. I don't even know how to describe it. They're really their own thing. It's kind of sludgy, it's kind of punky, but it's kind of rock. I don't know, but it's just good.
How do you discover new music? Is it something you just like scour the internet for, or does it come across your desk, or how does it get to you?
My inbox. Like Decibel's been around 14 years, and I started writing about extreme music in 1996. So I've just been on email lists for over 20 years. So pretty much everybody who has a record label has my email address, and links to albums just come through like almost on an hourly basis during the day. So there's no shortage of things to kind of check out.
Does that ever overwhelm you?
Oh God, yeah, every day.
Yeah.
there's things I don't get to, and then sometimes I get a reminder from a publicist. It's like, hey, dude, check this out. It's good. And I'm like, yeah. Everybody says that. And then sometimes if a writer is like, no, dummy, you need to listen to this. But, oh, okay. And so there's discovery, there's recommendations, there's recommendations from friends who are in other bands about bands that they're into. Like it's a fairly communal activity. A lot of these writers that write for Decibel, a number of them have been around since issue one. So they're friends. So mm-hmm. we just talk, we just talk about things, and stuff kind of comes up back and forth. Like, have you heard this or no? Somebody like, you might like this. I know what you like. Having known you for 20 years, you would like this. Here, check this out. So sometimes it's that, but generally it's like, generally the work isn't done for you. You just kind of find stuff.
How big is your staff at Decibel?
As far as full-time employees, there are there's four of us who work exclusively on Decibel. And then there's two other employees who work for the company that publishes Decibel. But they work on Decibel and some other things. So all told, there's six people who work on it and four of us who just work on nothing but Decibel. And then we have a staff of freelance contributors that's probably about 30 of them that are kind of scattered across the world.
Are you still writing, or are you just editing most of the pieces?
Oh, God. Yeah, I write so infrequently. I can barely vomit out my editor's notes at this point. if I'm at, an event that we haven't put on, like if I'm at Maryland Death Fest, maybe I can do, a 150-word capsule review of a band that mm-hmm. I saw, but generally speaking, I don't dive in. There's just no... I don't have that kind of, I don't have the luxury to do that because it's fun. I would like to do that, and I kind of miss being able to do that, but it just, this schedule doesn't permit. It's not a good use of my time, basically.
Right. What is your favorite part of what you do? The one thing you're like, every day you're like, or maybe not every day, but every week you're like, I can't wait to do that.
Finishing issue is always gratifying, like sending it off to print, getting it back. From the printer and be like, hey, here's this thing we did. Announcing events is always fun. Announcing like big new products like books or like really cool flexi discs. The flexi series has been a crazy experience itself. I've got to literally release music from my favorite bands ever. Carcass, Napalm Death, Godflesh, At the Gates, Paradise Lost, like all these bands, they've done flexi discs. They've recorded music for us.
Can you explain the flexi? You've talked a lot about the flexi disc. What, for the person who doesn't know, which is me right now,
okay.
What is it?
How old are you?
I'm 26.
There you go. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, a flexi disc. It's a malleable piece of vinyl
mm-hmm.
That actually is it's the size of a 7-inch record, and it has music etched onto it. It's basically a 7-inch that you can bend, so you can fit it into a magazine, and you can kind of like fold it, and it's it won't get, depending on who at the post office handles it, it won't get completely destroyed in transit. But generally speaking, it's safe for mailing within a magazine, and you can, you know, like, you can fit a 7-inch worth of music on there, so you can fit about 6.5 minutes worth of music on there. And flexi discs were, if you really want to go way, way, way deep into the history, like, I mean, they were around, I think they were around as early as like the 40s and 50s. They were kind of gimmicky, used on like literally like on cereal boxes and stuff like that. They would have jingles on them.
Oh yeah, Michael like just that. Pulled up a picture. I definitely recognize these now that I see them. I didn't know that's what they were called.
And then in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, a lot of like punk labels used them. Like Earache Records was a flexi disc label to start. Like they were just making flexi discs of like kind of punk bands and putting them out there under the world. And then I'd say probably by like the 90s, they just went away. The demand for them was gone, and all the machines that were around to produce them got scrapped or sold or whatever, and they're just gone. And then like around 2007, I had a conversation with my friend Scott from Pig Destroyer. We were doing our first Pig Destroyer cover, and he was like, you know, he's like, if anybody makes flexi discs, maybe we could like do a, like we could record a Pig Destroyer flexi disc and put it in the issue. And I was like, dude, that'd be insane. And I did some research and like literally found no one anywhere who was making these things. This technology was just gone. And so I kind of like shelved it. And I don't know, a few years went by and I started like, I think another conversation with my friend Kevin Sharp from Brutal Truth, who was writing a column for Decibel at the time. And we were talking about it. And he was like, you know, he's like, did you ever think about doing a flexi series? And I was like, dude, I've had this conversation years ago. Nobody was doing it. Nobody was making these things. And he was like, why don't you look into it now? And I was like, I looked into it, and there was a place that was starting to do it. They had bought this machine and restored it. And I got in touch with them, and they, like, we worked it out, and we tried it out, and got, like, a big corporate sponsor to do the first one to kind of offset the costs to see if it would work. And the first disc we did was Brutal Truth. And we, you know, it was paid for by the corporate sponsor. It was actually Scion back when they were involved in the metal scene. They don't even make that car now. That model is, that model has been discontinued.
Right.
It went great. There was a great reception to it, and I just had a blast, like, kind of curating this thing. But by the second disc, so I were like, "Nah, we don't want to really do this every month. We don't know what you're thinking, but good luck." So we kind of had to like figure out how to make it viable financially, to where it could be this kind of piece of what we do, you know, do something unique that nobody else does, but not like jeopardize us financially. And it took a long time to kind of figure out how it would work. And I don't want to go too into those specifics just because it's super mundane, but like, you know, we just sent the 96th one to print last week. So we're closing in on 100 flexi discs, like almost 8 years later.
Oh, wow.
So it really, you know, it really has become obviously a staple of what we do. But yeah, that's what a flexi disc is, kids.
Well, we learned something new.
Yeah. So that's kind of, so they are like, that is something that is nostalgic. It was traditionally not a great sounding format. But the truth is, like, these flexis that are being produced today sound like a million times better than the shit I remember from the 80s.
That's just one-sided, right?
Yep. I mean, you can print two-sided, but we just do the one because it's hard enough to get and all the Flexi tracks that we do are exclusive to the Flexi series. So they're all like, the first time anybody hears them is through the series. it may eventually wind up on different things from the artists who perform them, like, down the line. But, like, we introduced them to the world, so getting those songs exclusive every month is a challenge. So, yeah, we just stick to one side.
Do you got anybody big planned for the 100th yet?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes, we do. And it ties back to that story I talked about in 2017. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Or 2007, I'm sorry.
Sure, sure. I got to ask you about this.
I was
looking up, doing some research on you, and Metal Sucks ranked you number 7 most influential person in metal. They created a list like we were talking about. It was the 25 most influential people in metal, and you were number 7. How do you feel about that? Did you know about that?
I kind of remember that. That's probably from like a few years ago or something, right?
Yeah, 2016.
Okay. I guess it all depends on what your qualifications are.
Sure.
What, you know what I mean? It's like, I can say, here are the 25 tastiest colors of M&Ms that I can think of. But unless you explain, like, what the criteria is, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much it matters. I mean, like, I don't... It's nice to be recognized.
Yeah, maybe I should say, do you view yourself that way?
No, I mean, not really. I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, there's plenty... I mean, pretty much anybody who makes music is more important than me. And I think there's probably... I'm going to go on record. I didn't count them up, but I think there's probably more than 25 people who do that. So no, I don't. But like, I guess, I mean, again, what I would say, it's nice and flattering to be recognized by essentially industry peers who appreciate, you know, what we do with Decibel and all the things related to Decibel. Like, that's cool. Thank you. But as far as like me believing in that ranking, no.
Do you have who was influential to you in metal?
In the industry, or
yeah, however you want to answer it.
I mean, just people who conduct themselves with integrity, people who aren't full of shit. People who I trust, who I've known for a long time, who, like, I kind of know that they're just people you know you can trust that aren't... Because it's like in any industry, you know how it is. It's like whatever field you're working in, there's, like, people who you kind of know are doing it the right way, and then other people you're like, okay, how'd you get here?
Mm-hmm.
What's your motivation with this? And it's generally the people who are... extremely genuine and passionate about this stuff, this scene, this music. And there are a lot of lifers. You know, there's friends I've had for decades. People like Gordon Conrad at Season of Mist, Gerardo Martinez at Nuclear Blast, Nick Storch at Artist Group, you know, the people I work with on Decibel, our art director, our marketing director, our ad sales guy, like these people, like they inspire me because they work incredibly hard on Decibel alongside me and really kind of help me kind of utilize or kind of help me realize this vision for this thing that I've had all these years. Like without them, I can't really make it all work. So seeing them invested in it is always like gratifying too. But, you know, I mean, there's people who I enjoy what they do. Like a lot of our writers, I'm inspired by some writers that have come long before anything that I did with Decibel. Like people like Nick Terry, who used to edit Terrorizer. Somebody like Catherine Ludwig, who used to edit Metal Maniacs, people like that. Even Borvoy, who runs Blabbermouth, used to was a pretty huge fixture in zine culture and was one of the earliest Metal Maniacs contributors in like the early 90s. So, you know, it kind of goes back a little further than me, but it goes back a little further for me, but it's kind of an amalgamation of a lot of people over a lot of eras.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a good answer, and I you're kind of talking about going back, and I was just thinking, when was that moment that you kind of first connected with metal? Do you remember that?
I mean, I can remember having like my first real metal friend when I was like 12 years old, like who came to my then Catholic school,
mm-hmm.
You know, wearing a jean jacket with an Iron Maiden Stranger in a Strange Land back patch on it.
Badass.
And he was immediately like ostracized by this, you know, sixth grade community. But since I was a giant loser, he and I got along perfectly fine. And I can remember, you know, I still have some of the mixtapes that he made me back then.
That's awesome.
And
put those on the Flexi.
Yeah, right. But you know, it's like some of that stuff, it's like there's never really like a eureka moment mm-hmm. for me with metal in general. I mean, there's eureka moments with like certain types of metal. Like there's a eureka moment with death metal. Like
what's that?
You know, like I can like a record like Obituary Cause of Death, mm-hmm. you know, like hearing that for the first time in like 1990 or 1991, that was like a huge game-changing swing for me.
Is that your favorite subgenre?
I think it's a subgenre I'm most knowledgeable about. I mean,
that's what your book's pretty much about, right? Choosing Death?
Yeah, Choosing Death is it's death metal and grindcore, but I mean, primarily death metal. So yeah, mm-hmm. I think you can definitely, that's accurate. So I mean, I don't know what's my favorite. I mean, I like doom metal quite a lot and all kinds of different types of doom metal. I like traditional metal. I like plenty of unclassifiable metal.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess like death metal is a certain sweet spot for me that generally works. There's plenty of death metal I fucking hate. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
So you know, it isn't just an immediate seal of approval. But yeah, I guess I'd say it's probably something I'm a style I'm more knowledgeable.
Did you play an instrument, or were you in a band?
Yeah, I mean, not well. not well at
been
all.
There.
I used to play bass, and then I was like, yeah, I'm not fit for this side of the equation here. So yeah, no, I haven't played anything since. Jesus Christ, that was like 20.
Mm-hmm. When did the idea for Decibel, I mean, I know you said you've been around for 14 years, but I guess how did it come about?
I guess it germinated, I'd say a few years before the launch. Like the company that publishes Decibel, at the time, the only thing we published were free music magazines for independent record chains across the United States. So we did like these like kind of general audience music magazines that would be distributed at mom and pop record stores.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran like I edited the whole publication, but I also like wrote the metal section, whatever. But you know, this was like, that was the business model of that business from 1993 to about 2004.
Okay.
And I started working for it full time in 1997. And by the early 2000s, it was pretty clear that the landscape of the music industry was changing dramatically. Records weren't selling quite what they used to. Some of these mid-size independent chains were going out of business. And, you know, I had this idea. Our publisher, who was, you know, for several years, the company was just he and I. It was like two people. So we were good friends and we were close. And I was like, you know, I think I can do a metal magazine. I have a vision for what something should be, and it doesn't exist. It's a niche that I think I could fill. And, you know, we talked about it, and the time was just never quite there, or the resources weren't there. And then things just kind of started lining up, and I'd say late 2003, early 2004, and he greenlined it around then, and, you know, got the first issue rolling. I started working on the first issue in the summer of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was, you know, he had to, he believed in it and kind of believed that I was crazy enough to be able to do it, because, I mean, I did pretty much everything. I mean, I sold all the advertising, I assigned and edited and all the content, wrote a bunch of it, you know, got all the art, did all the all that management, did like directed all the photo shoots, all that shit. And I did that for years. but definitely, you know, it kind of taught me like what you need to do to get something like this off the ground. But yeah, that's, I mean, it really was just started out of like, you know, this is what I like, and I think I could do this. Like, I think there's nobody that's making this magazine that I want as a fan. Is really the impetus for it,
and
which I guess has just been the. I'm sorry. I guess it's just been the impetus for everything that we do.
Right.
Then too.
Yeah, providing that content that's not available, pretty much.
Right.
So, how did you originally? I guess I'm kind of interested. How did you get bands to notice you? How did you get anybody to notice you right away? Was it just because not many people were doing something like this?
You mean with Decibel?
Yeah, with Decibel.
Well, I had an advantage because I had been kind of a part of this industry for several years. I mean, from 96 to like 2004, and I was involved in these publications that like everybody in the kind of metal scene, in terms of like the record label metal scene, kind of knew who I was because I was writing about their bands in these publications that would just kind of show up in all these record stores. So they knew who I was. So when I said, "Hey, I'm starting this magazine," they didn't think I was completely full of shit out of the gate. So I had that. The other thing, and this wasn't planned at all, was in 2002 I started writing Choosing Death, and it was published, the first version of it on Feral House was published in September 2004. So it was the first issue of Decibel and the first pressing of Choosing Death came out within weeks of one another. And Choosing Death being the first book about, like, the first, you know, book anywhere really about death metal, it got a lot of attention and a lot of press. And Decibel hitting around the same time, like the two entities were kind of able to ping pong off each other, their promotion wise, you know what I mean? It'd be like anytime I did an interview about Choosing Death, I was able to mention Decibel, or if somebody was writing about Decibel, they would mention Choosing Death and vice versa. So that was definitely a, that helped, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just in general, you know, like, I think it was clear that what we were doing was different than what was available at the time. I mean, the magazines on newsstands in the U.S., metal magazines back then were like Metal Maniacs and Revolver and Outburn, and there were a bunch of zines that were fairly distributed here, like Unrestrained was still around, and something called Throat Culture that I kind of remember being around, and a bunch of other shit I'm sure I'm forgetting about right now that isn't around anymore, but like, it was still like what we were doing was, again, a bit different than everything else that was out there. So I think it was a little easier to stand out and help kind of establish it out of the gate as something different. And, you know, everything else that I've mentioned leading up to that as well.
Did you go to college?
I did, yes.
Okay, and then was it specifically for kind of, I don't know, what was the major, I guess?
English.
Oh, okay.
So completely useless. ultimately, I mean, it was funny. I actually started working for our publisher, I think it was my junior year of college. And, you know, I think I had like one, like, I don't know, about 6 months or something into, 6 or 8 months into my tenure. He was like, yeah, you should really just drop out. And I was like, dude, I got like one semester left. He's like, yeah, but it doesn't matter. And I was like, you know, I know it doesn't matter, but like, I don't really think I can tell my family. Like, I was like a few months away from graduating. I was just like, oh, fuck it. He's like, oh, that'd be so dramatic. I was like, yeah, it's true. But I mean, for me personally, I guess I learned some things that are applicable to what I do. But like, I didn't go to school for journalism. I didn't go to school for marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has become, you know, a pretty substantial part of what I do. I didn't go to school for psychology, which also, when you're managing personalities, becomes a significant part of what you're going to do, whether you want to or not. I did go to college, but I'm not saying don't stay in school, kids, but, you know.
Yeah, well, you never know. You never know it's like the butterfly effect or whatever. Maybe,
right.
Maybe if you didn't go to college, somehow you wouldn't end up at Decibel. I don't know.
It's true.
What can we expect from Decibel? I know we've been kind of taking a trip down memory lane for you here, but what can we expect from Decibel in the years to come?
I guess whatever I have left the capacity to withstand. I do feel in a lot of ways I'm kind of at maximum capacity with what we can produce right now, which is fine. Like, I think we're doing so many good things and so many interesting things that it's okay if I don't add something new to the mix in the next 6 months. I think it's just doing what we do and getting better at those things, getting more efficient, and doing more of what we do now, you know, more books, more special issues, more interesting content, whether that's in print or online, both, hopefully bigger Decibel tours. The one for 2019, the lineup is just ridiculous. I'm not giving any spoilers because it's too early, but it's just stupid. It's, you know, it's the 8th year of the tour, and it's the best one we've ever done. So,
awesome.
There's that. You know, it's growing Metal and Beer Fest. Not necessarily in terms of the amount of cities that it's in, but maybe the size of it that it is in those cities. you know, seeing how that goes. Like I mentioned a little bit before, there's a couple books on the horizon for 2019 mm-hmm. that I'm really excited about, that I'm not writing, mind you, of course.
Right.
That, you know, just, and then again, just kind of, trying to get better at what we do, you know, like we can still, there's obviously still room for improvement with the writing and getting that tighter and maybe getting a little more adventurous with content now and again, being able to take chances, you know. Like, I'm proud of the fact that this is a magazine that can put Yob and Tribulation on the cover in 1 year, and Pig Destroyer, and also put Judas Priest and the next issue, which is going to come out in a few days, has got Ozzy Osbourne on the cover.
Yeah, I think that's awesome.
You know, like, took us 14 years to get an Ozzy Osbourne interview, but we got it. but, like, you know, for us, it's like, and I don't think that we're full of shit by doing either of those things. You know, mm-hmm. It isn't like when you see some magazine put, like, I don't know, Mastodon on the cover 1 month and then put Avenged Sevenfold on the cover the next. You're kind of like, okay.
Right.
If you think so. so, like, for us, it's just been like, you know, what's genuine? What do we actually like? What are we not, like, trying to ram down people's throats? And, yeah, just kind of, to use a horrible cliche, staying true just to who we are. Not necessarily to a movement or a scene, but to just, like, you know, really who we are.
Well, I think, you know, you're never going to run out of things to do, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's a blessing and a curse.
Mm-hmm.
At times, but yeah, no, I agree. This certainly feels like that.
And no, all those things you're talking about are awesome and exciting to me and Michael, who, I mean, very passionate about this genre as well. I have just a couple. These are just quick lightning questions, and then we will let you go, Albert, after these.
Sure.
You ready for them?
Yeah, hit me.
Just first thing that comes to mind, is hardcore music metal?
No, it's hardcore, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be appreciated by the same people who like metal. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't fall under the umbrella of extreme metal. Like, to me, Sick of It All, who I love, like, that's a hardcore band. That's not a metal band. You know, I mean, Cro-Mags,
mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, like, you're allowed to like stuff that isn't metal if it's heavy, and if it's not metal, or if it doesn't fit all the dumb constructs of
right.
metal, it's okay. You just have to like it, so it's fine. Just because something doesn't have all of the qualifications of metal doesn't necessarily disqualify it from being good.
Do you consider yourself a metal elitist?
No. But I certainly was one at a period in my life. I would say 1994 to about 1996, I was fucking insufferable. and I was like, that's when I was like super deep into obscure doom metal and black metal, and I just didn't want anything to do with anything else. You know, I literally like bands like, I wouldn't even buy like the U.S. pressing of certain records from bands I liked. I would have to get like the original European.
Oh, wow.
Of them. Yeah, I was awful, terrible.
You had a nice 2 year stretch there.
Yeah, really. Which at a time when I could ill afford to do so, I was like in college, like genius. Like, no, you don't have any money to eat, but you have the original Peaceville pressing of the first My Dying Bride EP. Congratulations.
Do you think metal elitism? Is it good for metal, or is it bad for metal, or is it, you know, is it like a necessary evil?
I guess it depends on who it's coming from, and if who it's being directed at actually gives a shit, you
true.
Know, like, because it's all in a bit of a vacuum, like if somebody is like, you know, like looking down on me. Saying, man, you're not metal. You don't you won't stand for the things that I have ascribed to this this movement, and you fall short of my expectations of what this is all about. I mean, I'm just going to be like, okay, dude. And that's the same thing that's going to be true of any band, you know, like, they're going to be like, it's like kind of a shoulder shrug.
True.
So, like, I mean, I've been there, so I understand the passion mm-hmm. and the investment that goes into taking this thing and identifying so closely with it that you feel some kind of ownership of it.
Right.
You don't, though. It's not yours. It doesn't belong to you. It can feel like it does, but it doesn't. So, like, the moment you start acting like you're somehow above something, or somehow the genre police in a way, like, it's all bullshit. But again, I respect where it comes from, and I think that passion is important. I think it's ultimately misguided. But I think you kind of have to work through it to kind of figure it out. And hopefully you get to the other side of it. Hopefully it doesn't even take you 2 years like it took me. But, you know, it's like all you can do is just kind of shrug your shoulders and move on, I think.
Hopefully there's some metal elitists listening and they can identify with what you're saying.
They wouldn't listen to you at all.
That's true. We are not good enough for their taste. Now, you don't have to be specific with this. Are there any bands you or records you put in the Hall of Fame that you regret? Answer it how you want. It's kind of a loaded question.
Yeah, there are. There's only one, really. And I feel like I've spent some time making amends for it by inducting two additional records from that band that belong there into the Hall of Fame also. Mm-hmm. And it's an early misstep, and that was putting Sepultura Roots in the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
Which I think is it's a totally okay record with some really interesting moments on it, but the fact that it was inducted into the series early on and inducted before Beneath the Remains, inducted before I Rise, inducted before Chaos AD, which I wouldn't even induct in the Hall of Fame, inducted before Schizophrenia. There's three records from Sepultura that should go in before it. We put two in after it. So, yeah, I would say that was a misstep. But at the same time, my thinking was like, you know, we did it in 2005, I think we inducted it. And my thinking was at the time, it was like that was the record that was resonating the most with the music that was out around that time or that had come in its wake. Like for as much as I loved Beneath the Remains and Arise and everybody I did growing up with, like those were our Sepultura records, like the influence of those albums wasn't as apparent as the influence of an album like Roots, per se, on extreme metal. So I felt like, oh, well, you know, it makes more sense to put this record in there. This is like the fourth or fifth record that was inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
So it was where maybe the parameters of what constitutes a Hall of Fame album weren't quite as cemented as they are today.
Is it a vote? Do you guys vote on, you like, does everybody nominate a band, or is this like, you're like, I think Roots should be in this month, and then people are like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's no call to the round table or anything. I mean, like, I definitely handle pitches from writers who will, you know, hit me up and be like, hey, you know, we should induct this, or what do you think about this? And I'm like, maybe, maybe not, or let me think about it. And then, like, sometimes, like, 10 years will go by, and I was like, you know what, you're right, it's time, let's do that one. Or sometimes there's just stuff that, like, there's fucking no-brainers, like, of course we have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some that, like, come out of nowhere where somebody's like, have you ever thought about this? And be like, oh, geez, yeah, let's try to do that. And then, you know, sometimes they take 10 years to get done from when you start working on them. So, yeah, there's no formal submission policy.
Sure.
But there is a the crew of writers who generally do them. There's probably a half dozen or so of them who are the regular Hall of Fame contributors. They, from time to time, will hit me with an email with, like, hey, a few ideas. What do you think of these? And we kind of go from there sometimes. Or I'm just like, you know what? Can we do this? Like, something will pop into my head. Like, this works. Is everybody still alive? They are. Okay. Let's see if we can do this.
Why is metal bigger in Europe?
I don't know.
Me either.
Maybe because maybe because Europe is smaller. I don't know.
That could be.
You know, countries are smaller. I've never. It's just something that is, and I haven't really thought about breaking it down.
Have you? Have you heard of Gimme Radio?
Yes, I have done a show for Gimme Radio, and I'll be doing. In fact, I have to somehow cut one this week at some point.
I did not know that. What are your thoughts on Gimme Radio?
I think it's cool. I mean, they're clearly trying to do something with the format, and they really are trying to, like, kind of gather up a collection of talent, a collection of names, personalities, and for people who like streaming curated music, I think it's great, and I think it'll expose a lot of people to new bands and get people kind of hyped on sounds they might not normally check out, because curated streaming radio is just, like, it's a lot different than, you know, reading a magazine and saying, hey, that's a record I want to check out.
Right.
Versus, hey, I just heard that. What is that? I want to hear more of that. So yeah, I mean, the only good thing could come of it. And, you know, I've met the people who've put it on. They came to the last Metal and Beer Fest in Philadelphia, and it's just like this really nice, enthusiastic, genuine group of people. And there's a bunch of Decibel Riders who have shows. So, you know, there's almost, in a sense for us, kind of a familiar family element to it.
Yeah, we, it's been a while now, but we interviewed Tyler Linane on this podcast, so he was really nice to talk to.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. I like Tyler a lot.
Bringing us to our last question, will Decibel ever do a podcast of their own?
We did one. I think we did about 6 episodes.
Okay.
This was, the last episode was, happened in about 2014. And it was with our old managing editor and I, our old managing editor, Andrew Bonazzelli, who left that position in 2016. So he and I were good foils for one another for a podcast. But I just don't have the desire and the bandwidth and the, I just don't have it. I mean, like, I feel like we could do something. I'm sure it'd be fun and interesting, but, like, I think we've reached a point with Decibel where we just kind of have to be very selective in what we take on, and, like, you know, like, again, it becomes like, is this a good use of our time?
Makes sense.
Do we really need to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And if we had an infinite amount of time, sure, why not? It'd be fun. I could have some beers while we do this. I can talk some shit and talk to somebody, and it'll be a blast. But, you know, life just doesn't necessarily keep all those windows open at the same time for you. So, you know, I don't want to rule it out from ever happening again, but it's just not on the radar at the moment.
Any last thoughts before we let you go?
I really have to pee.
Ditto.
That's the only thought running through my head right now.
We've been chatting for a while, and you've been more than game to talk, and we appreciate that.
No problem, guys.
So yeah, thanks so much, Albert, and have a good night. Good luck to Decibel.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, thanks for asking me to do this. I appreciate the interest.
Again, we'd like to thank Albert for being on the podcast. Super interesting guy. Learned lots.
Yeah, definitely. Got a lot of, you guys did too.
Got a lot of bands to go through on his list of
a lot
stuff
of new
he's
bands.
Listening to.
Hopefully we can check them out and then feature some of them on future episodes.
For sure. Absolutely. So with that, horns high.